Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Thursday, January 30th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
So Jared writes to us, and I think this is a really good question because I was trying to ask this earlier, and he puts it very well, which is, so last I checked, the memo for the freeze was rescinded, but the White House press secretary claims the freeze is still in effect or pending despite the rescission. Confusion is the freeze was detailed in the memo that was rescinded. So what is actually happening?
Does the press secretary actually know? And that is part of my point.
And to add to the confusion here, and yes, I'm willing to certainly put some of this on the press secretary. But yesterday, moments before the president spoke, the announcement from the OMB was that the freeze had been rescinded, correct?
So
the memo has been rescinded.
They're very careful. They're saying two separate things. I'm told, and what I read and what some people discussed last night, is that there's a legal difference. If the memo has been rescinded, but the freeze has not been lifted. And they said, except for they broaden the scope of the things that they say are not covered under the freeze. So, for instance, I don't know if it's today or not, but they were going to reopen the portal for Medicaid. They were going to reopen the portal for the daycare funding. But they said that there was a legal distinction with the court cases that they thought that by rescinding the memo, they could slow down the court case and they wouldn't have to go to court on Monday. But then last night, the judge said, nope, you're still coming and, you know, you still have to come to court on Monday.
The Washington Post aptly pointed out that this is a lot like the Muslim ban in the first Trump administration. But the fear I have with that is if you're the Trump administration, kind of the quote-unquote right way to do this is to go ahead and look at all the expenditures that we're putting out and then go look at the laws that allegedly mandate these expenditures. And if you find something that is objectionable, that's questionable under the law, then you rescind that and you have the court battle. That's what I assume most administrations do. What the administration did was put out this clumsy memo and do it across the board. But that's, you know, that's part of the Trump play, right, which is to sort of flood the zone with all this news. But I think Teresa's right. I mean, in the meantime, you know, RFK took off his tinfoil hat. I'm not sure. I mean, Kash Patel, I'll quote The Economist. I mean, Kash Patel, whose confirmations hearings start today, I believe,
he's on
this morning.
Right now, yeah.
The Economist called him a crackpot. I mean, he's dangerous. He should be nowhere near the FBI.
And he has a target list. He literally, in a book, has a target list.
And then there's on top of that, there's Tulsi Gabbard. And the Republicans are so supine. And the Democrats can't get their the Democrats are having trouble getting their resistance act together. I thought when we didn't have a huge march like we did at the beginning of the first Trump administration, I thought we'd kind of all gotten the joke that being on the streets all the time wasn't the answer. The answer is we have to take specific issue, frankly, within government itself, ideally, and within institutions that watch government, every time Trump steps over the line. The Democrats haven't quite proven themselves up to the task. And as simple evidence for that, I offer the following. Their meeting to discuss the response to that two-page letter was scheduled for 1 p.m. yesterday, by which time the courts had already ruled against
between then and now. And
but they hadn't had their formal organization meeting. That's a failure.
I understand they didn't have their formal meeting, but they did get people to speak out, and people did speak out, and they were heard, right? And the White House obviously felt the heat. And the Republican offices obviously felt the heat. What didn't happen is the Republicans reportedly, while publicly they were saying, well, you know, everybody does this. This is why I object to people saying everybody does this, because that's the Republican public line. Everybody, they went to the microphones yesterday. Everybody does this. They don't. But reportedly, behind the scenes, they were calling up the White House and saying, what the heck?
Yeah.
You know, that's not exactly what they were saying. But but then people were calling the White House, and people keep saying to me, well, what can we do in times like this? What can we do? And here's a perfect example of what people can do. If there are programs that they are care about, familiar with, or informed about, and they could shed some light on, well, this is what happens if you shut down the funding for this program. That's the kind of information that needs to be put out there. And we need a, you know, hashtag not what I voted for or something. You know, we need a good catchy hashtag. But again, I know it was on C-SPAN, so not a lot of people listen to it. But go listen to Senator Maggie Hassan's speech last night. If she went around the country giving that speech, it would wake people up to what's happening.
Democrats are bringing a knife to a gunfight.
Right.
I saw some advice from the Democrats, just quotas about how often they should tweet, post on Facebook, like once a day. That this is not how they should be structuring their reaction to what President Trump is doing. And they really can't even agree on what approach to take. Should they be more progressive? Should they veer to the center? I mean, it's more than their messaging. It's where they want to take the party. I also think that the Washington media can't cover this. I think this is something that you're going to see covered. The news is going to come from the local. It's going to move up. That's why this is important, to find out exactly what grants are being cut. I mean, this is where the real news is going to happen, because the national media is being thwarted at every turn.
Oh, and the national
spot
media.
On. You are spot on, mm-hmm. Judy.
Can we talk? Can we just for a second talk about the national media?
How about 30 seconds?
Oh, that's quick. But so there was a piece in the New York Times talking about how Chuck Schumer really was at the foreground of getting Biden to resign. I mean, obviously Chuck Schumer's people planted that. That piece made me ill. It was such a friendly piece, and obviously planted. And then even yesterday, the Washington Post could barely bring itself to criticize the Democrats for their slow response. Those two papers.
Mark, the Democrats are the problem right now. I know that's your thing, but right now, our democracy, this is a problem with the threat to our democracy.
But both can be true. Well, I mean, in the sense of there can be the problem and there can be a better way of answering it.
Right. But I think the call now has to be, what is the Republican leadership going to do? Again, I go back to the same thing. With Nixon, what did they do? Ultimately, the Republicans went to him and said, this is not how we are. The Republicans,
they're going to remain supine. That's what the Republicans are. Look elsewhere
for
your
solution. They're the problem.
Look elsewhere for a solution.
Well, the problem is that we need to put pressure on them, because in their districts, Medicare is getting cut in their districts. I mean, Medicaid's getting cut in their districts. Child care is getting cut. What do they really want? The inflation, the clean energy provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act to be cut in their districts?
The other big story yesterday was during the president's remarks and the bill signing that he spoke at yesterday. He made news by saying that the U.S. will hold migrants at Guantanamo. And this was, I think, a bit of a surprise for many as it was being announced. The president suggested that 30,000 migrants could be housed on the base. It's unclear how that plan will take shape. Mr. Trump did not offer details on how that plan would work, but he instructed the Department of Defense and Homeland Security to get the site ready. We have 30,000 beds in Guantanamo to detain the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people, he said. Some of them are so bad we don't even trust the countries to hold them because we don't want them coming back, so we're going to send them out to Guantanamo. He said the move would double our capacity immediately, adding that Guantanamo was a tough place to get out of. In recent weeks, about 40,000 immigrants have been held in private detention centers and local jails around the country, as funding constraints have limited the number of detention sites. Adding 30,000 beds would dramatically expand the government's detention capacity. a site on the 45-mile base, could hold those 30,000 deportees. That site is on the opposite side of the body of water called Guantanamo Bay from the Pentagon's prison for terrorism suspects. All right, Mark Whitman, we'll give you first crack at this.
Huh, thanks. You know, I go back to an article I read recently that was called Trump for Dummies, and it went through sort of what Trump does on a regular basis, which I think this was all in The Economist. You identify a real problem, and then you exaggerate it to stir up emotions, right? So immigration's a problem. But here he is talking about that we allegedly have 30,000 criminals that we're so afraid of that we have to put them in a military base. Now, we all know that's not true. But then what he does is he promises sort of vague solutions. I mean, 30,000 beds. Does anyone here really think that the first weather event that hits Cuba is going to that there'll be 30,000 beds standing after that happens in whatever tent city that they set up? Now the Democrats, right, the Democrats and the opponents are going to have a sort of a extreme reaction, and Trump's going to respond by saying, well, there really is a problem here. We really need to solve it, and you didn't. So he's going to exploit theirs. And then their reaction. And then the magic thing that he does is whenever there's a slight improvement, and he's already started this on immigration now that border crossings have been reduced dramatically, which, by the way, they were reduced under Biden. But then he starts to claim success anyway and claims it all for himself. This is just the same thing. And obviously the worry here with Guantanamo is that when you're not on American soil, as those accused of crimes associated with 9/11 have learned, your legal status is even more tenuous than when you're a non-citizen in the United States. And you shudder to think what this administration will do with that ambiguity as part of this. So I think it's part of his playbook, the way he announced it and what he said, and there's going to be an inevitable reaction that he's going to capitalize on. And I really do worry at the human cost of this, given the way the administration conducts this. And I go back to the same point I made around the executive orders to check spending. You know, cracking down on immigration, I mean, the Obama administration famously did that. There are always errors and frictions in people's lives when you do that. The problem is when you do it in such a heartless way that the Republicans are this Republican administration is going about it, the human costs become horrific.
And financial costs.
I just want to mention real quick before we go back to Teresa that President Trump is scheduled to speak at approximately 11 o'clock this morning regarding the helicopter and airplane crash that took place last night over the Potomac River in Washington, D.C. We will have NPR coverage of the president's remarks coming up as soon as we learn. We'll get a two-minute warning, and then we'll go over to that at the top of the hour. Teresa.
Do you think he'll begin by apologizing for his distasteful tweet or whatever you call it?
What do you think, Teresa?
not holding my breath.
What was his distasteful, if I may?
Last night.
Well, I didn't.
He was, well, you can
no,
say.
No, go ahead.
I mean, he was basically saying, questioning as to the, he said it wasn't good and that it could have been prevented and that it was the helicopter. Why could they have not gone up or down or right or left and went into the plane instead?
Why did this happen? Yeah. I mean, it was just so inappropriate as they were, you know, first responders or, and it was the first thing out of the box. When you don't know if people are alive or dead, the people are just beginning to learn who's connected to this. It's just the lack of empathy stunning. Back to this. sorry, I should.
Makes me pine for the days of the Impoundment Act. Go ahead.
We shouldn't be laughing at that. But one of the things that was interesting to me about this announcement, which, by the way, made me think about the ACA, you know, we don't have a plan, we have a concept for a plan.
Right.
This is really much, you know, we have a concept for a plan here. But what he said at the press conference where he was signing the bill about how what a tough, tough place this is, and we're, you know, we have all these tough people who they need to be there, detain the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people, and it's a tough place to get out of. Well, then Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is on Fox at approximately the same time, and he was singing a whole different song. He was talking about how this is temporary transit while the U.S. officials complete their paperwork, travel arrangements. This is just going to be a short-term pass-through place, completely different. And what I learned, and I didn't realize, is that there are the Guantanamo that I thought about, and Hegseth actually had been stationed at Guantanamo, so he knows of what he speaks. There are two different locations. There is the high security place where the 9/11 arrested folks 20 years later are still being held without being charged. Side comment. And then there is a base that does house, in theory, about 30,000 people, but by all accounts, it's hasn't for a long time. They are using it now as a transit point for some. Biden administration did also, but it's not up to date. It couldn't handle 30,000 people with a tremendous amount of rehabilitation. And so the question is, what's the cost? How long is it going to take? And Guantanamo, I know there are millions of dollars. And then all of the issues that you raised, which are very important, which are the legal issues of what is their status when they are, if they're on a base, is that U.S. status or not? I don't know the legal question to that. If they're on a U.S., outside the U.S., but on a U.S. base, what's the...
My recollection from 9/11 was that because they weren't on U.S. soil, that there was some argument as to their legal status that right. made it less
but
certain.
But has that argument been resolved? I don't know.
Has it been resolved, or is it possible that the Trump administration will continue to exploit the right. perception of ambiguity? I think that's the better question.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, January 30th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, January 31st, Joe was joined by CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
And, you know, look, of course, there is the tragedy, the plane crash that happened on Wednesday night, and it appeared to confirm what safety experts had been warning for years. Growing holes in the aviation system could lead to disaster. And it was, we learned yesterday morning, we did talk about this on the air, but that there are no survivors of this tragedy. 67 people losing their life as a result of those who were in the American Airlines plane and the three and the Black Hawk helicopter. Divers continue to scour the Potomac River. I believe one black box has been found. There is another that is being searched for, and as well as just other clues and seeking answers in a deadly crash. I don't see a whole lot of a whole lot of gain in focusing a bunch on the president's remarks yesterday about blaming DEI and DEI policies, as well as Presidents Obama and Biden for the crash. I think you can all take those for what they are, and we'll certainly talk about them. But I would like to, you know, just focus on how we get an investigation. I One of the things that did strike me about the news conference yesterday, which we ran here on WAMC, was the president saying that an investigation, but we don't really need an investigation because we know what happened. And then he went on and basically said, we don't know what happened. So I think it's really important that we obviously find out those details so that we can avoid this anguish in the future. Nick Rangel.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you know, I'd be remiss if we didn't pause and just really sit with the loss of life that that occurred as a result. But I found, obviously, the president's comments on the issue, like, exceptionally offensive, but also very in line with how he talks about other kinds of tragedies, that the pivot away from the technical aspect of the cause and cause and effect of, you know, the science behind it or the policy behind it, that it's always used to launch this other kind of political agenda that is aligned with the topic of the day. So as much as I found it, you know, just incredibly offensive to claim that this was caused or the result of a DEI initiative, which again is civility in the workplace and like fairness as just concepts, it didn't really surprise me, just given the way that he's talked about other tragedies, the fires in California and so on.
And without any real empathy, I mean, it was there on the surface, but not. What struck me about his remarks about blaming DEI, and the only thing I would add to what you said is without any evidence whatsoever, that as he was speaking, bodies were being pulled out of the Potomac River in Washington, D.C. If there is a time for that type of name calling and finding blame and fault, I don't think there is. But if there is, it certainly wasn't at that moment, as there still is a frantic search for the remains of those who perished.
But that's not the leader that this country elected, though. I mean,
that's
not who they saw in his last administration, and it's not what he's – Donald Trump's not known for his empathy and great care of people
or evidence-based
of this country.
Policy.
Or evidence-based responses, right. I mean
– So who do we get our comfort from now? Aaron, that's on you. Go ahead.
for us.
I mean, this is a new low even for him. I mean, this was fair. I mean, in a series of never-ending lows, whether it's Charlottesville or the Black Lives Matter protests and the Bible photo op, like, I don't know. This struck me as something that just utterly lacked compassion, lacked empathy. I'm surprised he didn't blame FDR or someone while he was just going through his list. So the blame game, that's his MO, is, you know, on display, full force. I consider this kind of an assault on people's intelligence. I wonder if anybody actually believes him, that that was the motive. And there might be some, what I've seen called low information voters who perhaps don't follow policy issues that close, that might. But more importantly, I think this is just part of this is more of the qualitative part of the assault on the country's infrastructure. And you saw this with the spending freeze. But you know, when you think about a country's infrastructure and what allows us to live a normal, civilized life is funding for physical infrastructure, roads, bridges, dams, clean water, and so on. There's the human infrastructure, which is, you know, funding for education, vaccines, and so on. But what he's doing, I think, is kind of an insidious third strain, and that's an assault on the institutional infrastructure of the country. And whether that is, you know, trying to cut funding for the FAA, cut funding for just other types of important institutions that allow this to happen. And I'm not saying that this was, you know, that it was an accident. It wasn't Trump's fault. It wasn't Biden's fault. But, you know, instead of coming up with solutions, he just came up with, well, it's not my fault. It's everybody else's fault. And, you know, the point is to just one day at a time, one dumb statement at a time, just ram through this ideological assault that will cumulatively discredit a lot of institutions we take for granted.
Meanwhile, people are working incredibly hard around the clock to find out what did happen, and again to try to find the remaining bodies that are in the river. And we heard from Nick Rangel, we heard from Aaron Pasitti, and we now hear from Heather Mulligan.
Thank you. So I have a couple things I think I want to add to it. One, there's a lot of really good information on the Washington Post website. They've added some new information as of this morning. I think it really is important that, you know, we recognize that there's a lot of people whose lives were very negatively impacted by this. It's tragic. It's awful. The figure skating community has experienced loss like this before. And it's just, you know, as the stories come out about who was on the plane and who was in the helicopter, it's going to be more and more just heart-wrenching. First thought I had was the DEI thing was an attempt to shift the focus back to President Trump, right? He was attempting to take back the narrative and say something that would, you know, create more of a focus on him. And it's what's on his mind right now, right? He's been talking about eliminating DEI in federal agencies for a couple weeks. So obviously it's very much top of mind for him. Not surprising that's the first thing that he raised. But some of the interesting things that have come out since, for example, it sounds like the helicopter actually was not at the normal elevation. It was higher than it should have been. I heard that this morning. And also there's some transcripts that I heard of the air traffic controller attempting to communicate with the helicopter. And at one point they were non-responsive. And then at another point, he asked, can you see the plane? So it sounds like the air traffic controller was on top of this and was well aware that there was, and there was an alarm going off, I think, at air traffic control, that they were on a collision course. So it doesn't sound, despite the fact that FAA and air traffic control is, and we've known this for a while, very understaffed. People were super burnt out. Coming out of the pandemic, getting staff back to work, they're overworked. You know, there's a lot of issues with this entity that have been recognized before this administration. Despite that, it to me at this point sounds like there may have been some other issue other than air traffic control not recognizing that there was a problem here. The other thing that I heard this morning that I think is kind of new is a commentator on CNN saying, well, this happened because of the chaos and confusion caused by the spending freeze and the turnover at the FAA, which I think, again, you know, that's just it's a political shot back at the president. Maybe a counterpoint to his assertion that somehow DEI is responsible. But I think that's all just noise. I think we need to wait and see what the black boxes say. But it does sound like just a really tragic event. And I'm a person who flies on American Airlines into DCA fairly frequently. As do many members of Congress. And so I think that this is going to be taken very seriously. And there may be some questions raised about the wisdom of having military training flights on the same, you know, general flight path as commercial traffic.
In the path. And Nick, I'll come to you. I just want to say that there is the report that came out from the NTSB about the airport control tower was understaffed before the crash, which in and of itself I know is concerning, and yes, it should be concerning, but the number of understaffed shifts is quite high for all of the reasons that you just mentioned. The other quick thing I would like to make mention of, Nick, before I promise I will go to you, is that you know, this was brought up during the press conference yesterday and was batted away by the president very quickly. But the Trump administration launched the air controller diversity program that he is now decrying. He read a list of disabilities he calls disqualifying, but his administration started such hiring in 2019. So just fact check that as well. Nick Rangel.
I mean, it does seem like a strange time to both say that the FAA is extremely understaffed and then also not acknowledge that FAA staff all received the same please resign email this week, not once but twice. So,
right.
I mean, I think calling it turnover and recent turnover is sort of avoiding the fact that they were told to leave.
And right? Not just in air traffic control, but throughout the federal government, an overall reduction and the treatment of federal employees, of which
the bullying.
Yes.
The bullying of federal employees. And not in a strategic way. They're not saying, well, we think there's too many people in the HR department. Everybody got an email saying you should quit, including traffic controllers. I mean, that including the chief. I mean, that doesn't lend itself to strategy or thoughtful reduction in government. That's not a policy change. That is just a slash and burn approach to our public service.
You know, I will say that yesterday during the press conference when Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth was speaking and said, look, we know, and he was very complimentary to the president, and he was going along with what he was saying. However, he did say, but whatever else was going on, something happened here, and we have to get to the bottom of that. I believe he was the only person in that room at that time who actually said those words. So, you know.
Go Pete.
Kudos for that, I guess.
But see, that this is the problem.
That's such a low
bar. That, right. Trump has shifted the goalposts so far outside the bounds of civility that when the Secretary of Defense says something like that, we're saying kudos to him. No, we should be saying, yeah, of course. What else?
Yeah. Something right? Obviously went wrong.
Right.
Yeah. You look at that
congratulations,
video.
Congratulations.
You
yeah.
look at that video, you see the plane, you see the helicopter, and you say, yeah, something obviously went wrong. And now we have to figure out what it is and what caused it.
I just want to say, though, I mean, there's still this sort of breathless coverage of everything, you know, that the president has done wrong or done right, you know, depending on what network you turn on. And one of the things I heard this morning, you could tell I couldn't sleep, so
that 9 a.m. meeting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's what was killing me. Was someone saying, and he's not going to visit the site. And what they left out was the rest of the cliff. And he's like, the clip, which is, he says, well, it's in the water. I mean, like, how do I don't, you know, how do I visit? And but it was like, oh, and the president has now said that he's not going to visit the crash site. I'm like, okay.
It's a 5-minute walk.
Okay.
From the White House.
I know, yeah, but it's right. In the middle of the river, right? So, I mean, so I get his point. I'm not saying
it would
like
mess up
he's...
his hair. The wind and the water.
No.
But I'm like, stop with that. And can we just please, like, let's talk about what happened.
I also did not sleep at all last night. So let me just say this is what I was thinking about. But it's along the same lines. I agree with you. And I wish that we were talking about, I was just, God, please, let's talk about the people. Let's talk about
right.
What we know about them. Let's talk about how many are being taken out of the water, how many are being the bodies that are being recovered. Please tell us that information. The problem with that logic is that and because I'm screaming at the TV, like, stop talking about Trump, stop talking about Trump, stop talking about Trump. But,
we heard you.
But he's the one that changed the narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the one that changed the narrative. The reason that they're breathless on everything that he's doing now is because of what he said. And if that didn't happen, I don't think the other would have. I mean, eventually there would have been blame.
I mean, it all reminds me of fifth grade. I know you are, but what am I?
Right.
You know, I mean,
no,
and can
absolutely.
We like just? I think that it would be so awesome if someone in the media would sort of just focus on what happened, who, you know, the loss of life, you know, who was in, you know, the tragedy, what happened, what caused it, and just ignore, maybe ignoring, that's what you're supposed to do with a bully, right?
I do want to say there was a mix yesterday. I know on CNN, on MSNBC, even on Fox, there were military experts, there were aviation experts who were on the networks talking about what happened, talking about the flight pattern, talking about how difficult it is, talking about the possibilities. So, I mean, the information is there. It just also gets lost because of all the other stuff that goes around.
Right.
Nick, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I think that's, I agree with this conceptually, but if you fire the chief and you tell all your highest ranking people to quit and everybody else to quit, doesn't that make it more difficult to actually evaluate what happened, to piece together the data that can be collected and to like solve that puzzle? Like, you need experts in the department, in the agency, who can do that work. And we're looking at just this full kind of elimination of that expertise because we think experts and lifelong career staff as like the deep state. And you're like, no, the whole point of deep state, if you want to call it that, is that they have expertise and they know what's going on and they know how to study this. They know how to solve that problem. They will figure out what did happen. But if you're leaving what happened to the press, like, then you're going to have some guy who wasn't there say, well, you know, from my, like, I watched the video and I think this is what happened. No, there used to be people inside who knew what happened.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Friday, January 31st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, January 31st, Joe was joined by CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Let's go back to the panel and what is going on, and we go to the next item. Which is we'll give Aaron his due here and talk a little bit about the Fed.
So every 6 weeks, the Federal Reserve meets to determine the course of interest rate policy. And this was this past Wednesday, they concluded their 2-day meeting, which was the first meeting they had under the Trump presidency. And there was really no shock. They held interest rates steady at 4.5%, which is down from their peak rate of 5.5%. It's important to note that the interest rate the Federal Reserve controls, which is called the federal funds rate, is not the interest rates that consumers pay on home loans, auto loans, student loans, credit card loans, but it forms the foundation for that loan. So, you know, if the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, then, you know, banks will use that as their base and then add on a risk premium. So when the Federal Reserve lowers rates, that means interest rates in the economy go down, but the Fed controls a very specific interbank lending rate. So It wasn't so much the interest rate decision that caught my eye. It was what Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said and did not say during his in the Fed's press release and the press conference. He made it clear that the economy is still on very strong footing. The unemployment rate near a half century low at 4.1%. This morning, the Fed's preferred measure of inflation ticked up a little bit to 2.6%, but still substantially lower than it was. GDP growth is strong. So all of this suggests that over the next year, the Fed, and using Jerome Powell's words, will have monetary policy that's meaningly restrictive, meaning interest rates will stay high, so that it kind of puts a lid on economic activity. The Fed will probably cut interest rates 1 to 2 times in 2025. But the issue here is that that change in policy, the Federal Reserve said we were going to lower interest rates, 3 to 4 times in 2025, and they downgraded that to 1 to 2 interest rate decreases. So if you read between the lines, and listening to shows like this, where you can hear analysis of economists who are reading between the lines, is another good reason to donate. That change, which is buried in the Federal Reserve's summary of forecasts and their box plots, says we're not going to lower rates as much as we thought. And the very obvious reason for this is that the fiscal policy that President Trump has been proposing, tariffs, immigration restrictions, and deficit finance tax cuts, will all be inflationary in very different ways. Tariffs will raise the price of imported goods, and that ranges from everything from imported produce, say from Mexico, imported lumber from Canada, imported manufactured goods and steel from China, imported apparel from other countries. That's going to raise the price of imported goods consumers buy. The immigration restrictions will lower the labor supply, and that puts upward pressure on wages. Most of those wage costs get passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices, and deficit-financed tax cuts tend to have the effect of being inflationary and raising interest rates. So that's the story, is that the Fed is essentially taking it's kind of taking its foot off of the gas a little bit. They're not tapping on the brakes. They're taking their foot off the gas a little bit. And the reason they're doing so is kind of adopting a wait and see approach about what happens with the very uncertain outlook surrounding President Trump's fiscal policies. I think it was Heather that said, well, yeah, he proposes tariffs and then he backs off and then there's this and then there's that. And maybe the immigration restrictions and the deportations aren't as don't have the scope that he originally intended. So it's kind of tough to make sense of what actually.
I didn't say that part.
No, I know. Okay. But I'm saying
I don't want anyone mad at me.
You were talking about the general uncertainty surrounding we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's why the Fed is adopting a wait and see approach. So this isn't bad news for the economy, in that the Federal Reserve saying, well, we're going to start raising interest rates again, and that could lead to the increased probability of a recession. But at the same time, they're saying, yeah, we're not going to be decreasing rates as much as possible because we see the potential for an inflation threat around the corner. So everybody, fasten your seatbelts, tune in, because it is going to be an absolute, this is setting up a very public clash between Donald Trump and Jerome Powell later in the year. Part of Project 2025 is decreased independence for the Federal Reserve and increased political control of Federal Reserve decisions. There's a playbook for that. There's institutional support for that. Trump and Powell are going to go head to head, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that debate plays out. Because trust me, it will.
So a couple things I just wanted to add. I am not an economist, and I know there at one point there was a listener who said I shouldn't comment at all since I'm not an economist. But anyways, I know that at the end of the last quarter,
we wouldn't have a show if that were the rule.
Yeah, right. there was some softening of the labor market, but there's data that suggests that that may have stabilized in the beginning of this quarter for as short as we've had so far. But I was really interested yesterday to see that Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, agrees with President Trump that they should cut rates. And to me, I thought, you know what? They should get together. But she said, you know, that Powell is risking American jobs by not cutting rates. But obviously, the inflationary issue is one that you have to be concerned about. And the other qualifier that I heard again this morning was that there's now, with respect to the Canadian and Mexican tariffs that are supposed to go into effect tomorrow, which I'm not sure how that works, but that now maybe gas and oil or petroleum will be Canadian petroleum will be excluded. So I don't know if that's a fear of rising gas prices as an immediate reaction, but very, very interesting to see course corrections based on some information that's obviously been shared, like, well, we don't want gas prices to go up.
Right.
You know, you don't want to be blamed for that, right?
And, you know, we don't want to be imposing tariffs on Mexican produce because then grocery prices start going up even further.
Right.
And then, so this gets back to the uncertainty.
Right.
And in general, uncertainty is not good for an economy. Businesses make long-term investment decisions. Mary Barra was talking about some challenges GM was facing, that when you have this uncertainty, like, are there going to be tariffs?
Right.
If so, how high? Are there not going to be tariffs? So, you know, businesses started stockpiling inventory in the last quarter after Trump was elected. But, you know, to essentially get the imported raw materials they need while they're cheap. But the downside is that they need to store them somewhere. Not all raw materials have an infinite lifespan. Some are perishable. So there are costs to businesses of dealing with this uncertainty.
I mean, we represent a number of manufacturers Canada is our largest trading partner. And there are a lot of companies that manufacture in New York that have cross-border partners, and sometimes the product goes back and forth across the border multiple times. I don't know how that works with tariffs. The raw materials that are coming in from Canada that get used for manufacturing in New York, if they're subject to a tariff and you're someone who's supplying, let's say, a contract for the MTA or to make rail cars or something, for example, and they take a long time to get the materials, to get them on a line, and then to turn them over to the consumer, the customer. Those contracts go back 10 years, and they don't have built-in escalators for tariffs. So how does that work? I mean, there's a lot. I agree. There's a lot of uncertainty. The other thing that didn't come up, I think, is that GDP report comes out today.
Yes.
Is that, I don't know if that's out yet, but I'd be interested to see what GDP looks like right now, because it'll give us sort of a frame of reference if tariffs do go into effect. How does that, you know, impact it? And you can tell me if that would have any impact, but I think it would.
Thank you for the reminder about the GDP report. It grew at 2.3% in the fourth quarter, which was less than forecasted, but also, in the grand scheme of things, a stable rate of growth. Normally 2-3% is where economists peg that, meaning if the economy grows at that rate, you're going to have a stable labor market without rising inflation.
Right.
Right? It's the kind of the neutral rate of growth. So to your points, based on my understanding, the tariffs that Trump is imposing will be imposed on every border crossing. So for firms that, you know, like General Motors, who manufactures cars in Mexico and then brings them back to the U.S. to have, I don't know, doors put on and then sent back to have the tires. Every time that same car crosses the border, that tariff gets imposed. Mm-hmm. So that can be cumulative. The what was the other question you had about the long-term contracts?
Yeah.
Somebody's going to have to eat that cost, which means lower profit margins and less hiring. So not only could they be inflationary, they could be contractionary as well.
Nick, we have about 2 minutes. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think it just as listening to the conversation here, what comes to mind are, because we're in a state budget right now for New York, and states will be dealing with costs across the country, and so will the feds. all of the initiatives that are taxpayer funded will also face the same impact on tariffs and contractual obligations not being met, in addition to in your own home and household. And it just, you know, I'm starting to think, we have a housing shortage. How are we going to tackle a housing shortage if the cost of building houses to the state are tripled? And you know, the whole sort of wave of impact, I think it could be devastating, or it could potentially, if nothing really happens and we're just using the tariffs as a big stick, maybe won't have that much of an effect. But it's it is kind of a daunting like thought exercise to work through all of the different spaces that this that the threat of tremendous tariffs could have.
But back to the Fed though, Aaron. Good, bad. Was it the right choice? I want you to tell us.
So, you know, I mean, here's the one-armed economist problem again. On one hand, the Fed is still fighting inflation that remains kind of stubborn.
Yeah.
It's not equally spread. You know, it felt more acutely with groceries, but gas prices have plummeted
right
over the past 2 years. So, you know, inflation affects everybody, and it affects low-income consumers and smaller businesses more because they spend a larger share of their income on consumption. So when prices go up, they're forced to make very costly reallocations. So in one sense, fighting inflation, contrary to what Elizabeth Warren said, is positive. The other issue about, well, on the other hand, keeping rates high can kind of suppress business investment, consumer borrowing, and therefore job growth.
Right.
But the rise in unemployment over the past year has not been because of increasing layoffs. It's because people are coming off the sidelines and starting to look for work again.
Here we go. John says, my concern is how long can the Federal Reserve continue to be an independent agency? Trump will be trying his best to take control of monetary policy.
Well, that's the $30 trillion question. They've been independent to one degree or another since their inception in 1913. They are.
Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
This has nothing to do with what you're talking about. I just want to, because I meant to mention when I was talking, because Sarah's here and I wanted her to hear this. But Sarah, you mentioned that we had a listener from Ohio who called, and but that was your mom and dad,
Nick and Diane from Hudson, Ohio.
Oh, that's really sweet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thanks, Mom
we
and
were
dad.
Thinking Hudson, New York. No, Hudson, mm-hmm. Ohio, and it's Aaron's mom and dad, and we thank them very much. We thank them for listening, and thank you for having a great kid. So, yeah, good.
Wow. Yeah, they might disagree every once in a while. It's neither here nor there.
I doubt that. I met your parents. They're lovely, lovely people, and wonderful to have them on board and have them listening. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So the Fed is overseen by Congress. The Federal Reserve Chair makes a semi-annual testimony and answers questions from Congress. The Federal Reserve Chair, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors are all presidentially appointed and confirmed by the Senate. So it's not as if the Federal Reserve is this entirely independent, unaccountable government institution. It's that they operate with independence in a sort of similar way that the Supreme Court does, and that is politicians can moan and groan about their decisions, but, you know, those decisions are largely final. In my opinion, and I know my fellow roundtable colleague Mark Whitman agrees with me, and even John Faso agrees with me, so how's that for a triumvirate of viewpoints, that if Trump starts inserting himself too much, or there are bills that are proposed that can increase his influence in monetary policy, the three of us who are coming from very different positions all agree that that is a step too far. Financial markets would revolt because presidents want low interest rates to juice the economy, to create jobs. The problem is that creates inflation. And when you have that process sustained over multiple years, that inflation becomes embedded, and then we essentially become, you know, the North American version of Venezuela with some guardrails. So In my opinion, I think Federal Reserve independence will continue just because the revolt of financial markets and even Trump's Treasury Secretary, I'm forgetting his name, Scott, coming from Wall Street, I think that would be something he probably would not go along with.
So I think we should have a debate, and we'll have Aaron and John Faso and Whitman on one side, and then Trump and Elizabeth Warren on the other side. How fun would that be? Can you get that like on air? I think people.
We'll try to.
You get your own pal in there too while you're making the call.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, dream big, for goodness sakes. Let's go back. We need $8,104, by the way. 1-800-323-9262. Dive. Let's go. Let's make the money. And here we go. Let's go back to letters from our listeners. I am calling senators and my reps daily to urge them to resist what the president is doing. Do not allow it to become normal. Also, Rick says, my brother-in-law obsesses over the national debt. What can I tell him to reassure him that it's not like a family budget?
That is probably the, so excellent point, and that's a very common critique of fiscal policy. The federal government's spending power is not constrained the way household spending power is, because households have a finite lifespan. People die, bills are collected. The federal government has an infinite lifespan. So as long as there are people, whether it's private households in the U.S., investment banks, corporations, sovereign wealth funds, foreign governments who are willing to buy U.S. government debt, and they've been willing to do so at remarkably low interest rates over the past 20 years, that the U.S. government could run deficits in perpetuity. It's not the federal government has the power to tax. So if we're concerned about lowering the debt and the deficit, we could raise taxes. The federal government has the ability to print money. That could be inflationary, but it would allow us to pay off our creditors. So the federal government is fundamentally different than a household. The other issue is that when you look at the national debt just as a number, what is it, like $36 trillion or something?
Gazillion,
yeah. One gagillion dollars. I think it's like 30, let's call it $35 trillion. You know, every corporation also runs on debt. They borrow money. They use that money to invest, to raise the value of their assets. So when you look at the federal government's debt in isolation, it's this big, scary number. Oh, it's $35 trillion. Well, U.S. GDP, meaning the value of what we produce each year, is $30 trillion.
As of yesterday, 36.2.
Thank you. 36.2.
Wow.
I was close.
Yep. All right. I'm not going against you on Jeopardy.
we have – if all investors who loan the U.S. government money want it to cash in today – the U.S. government could sell its assets. We could lease off drilling rights in Yellowstone National Park. We could sell Texas to Mexico. We could sell California to China if we wanted to. Those are our assets. The resources under the ground are our assets. So,
but there is a cash flow to debt service issue, though.
Sure. No, there is. And again, that's where you get to the, how can you increase tax flow? That could either be through less spending or higher taxes.
Right.
That was Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, January 31st. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. The lockbox is open, and you can help support WAMC by going to wamc.org. A reminder that on Monday, the fund drive officially begins. We are now halfway to our goal with help from the generosity of our listeners. Show your support by donating to help us end the fund drive at wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.